This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, activists kick off the autumn season with renewed protests against police killings of Black people. The Russians step up the fight against Western-backed jihadists in Syria, while regime change refugees continue to flood into Europe.
But first, the Oakland, California-based Ella Baker Center for Human Rights conducted a survey of 1,000 former prison inmates and their family members. The study found that the burden of mass incarceration is borne not just by the 2.4 million people that are locked up in the United States, but also by their families, with women carrying a disproportionate share of the financial weight. Darius Young is a local organizer for the Ella Baker Center and a former prison inmate himself. He conducted some of the surveys and explained why it's necessary to look at how mass incarceration affects families.
We looked at it from the standpoint that we saw so many people in the 90s, the late part of the 90s, when we started our Books Not Bars campaign, was focused on shutting down juvenile centers throughout California and stopping the building of the super jail, that it was just more than the individual that was incarcerated that was impacted. It was also family members who were deeply impacted by a loved one's incarceration. So we wanted to get a whole assessment on the impacts of incarceration from across the board, because we understand that when an individual is incarcerated, then the impacts on the family, which translates back into the community, are enormous. So it just wasn't enough to be able to say this. We set out to be able to prove it through numbers, and not only putting numbers, but putting real faces and voices to the numbers.
When a member of the family gets caught up in the system, he or she costs the family money at trial, money when in the system, and money after release.
Yes.
And yet most of these families that you surveyed are poor themselves and made poorer by the experience of having a family member incarcerated.
Yes, that's correct. And in fact, our survey showed us that it's mainly African-American women who bear the brunt of loved ones' incarceration.
Well, give us some numbers on that. How is it that African-American women bear so much of the burden of incarceration, even though it is males who do most of the time?
The impact on the African-American women was phenomenal, simply because African-American men are more likely to be incarcerated than any other racial group here in America. That's the first thing. And so our survey showed that nearly one in five families, that's 18% involved in our survey, faced eviction. They were denied housing or did not even qualify for public housing once their formerly incarcerated family member returned. So what did that show us in terms of the numbers of women who actually have been denied public benefits, or even having their loved ones return home only to say that they can't reside with them because they live in public housing? So we found that it was, our statistics showed us that it was over 50% of the women that were impacted were African American. As a matter of fact, let me clarify that. In 63% of the cases, right, family members on the outside were primarily responsible for court-related costs associated with conviction. Of the family members primarily responsible for these costs, it was 83% were women. And of those 83% that were women, 65%, I believe, were African-American women.
And these court-related fines and fees can actually add up to more than lots of people who are poor, living at around the poverty line, make in a year.
Yes, that's correct.
About 700 former inmates were part of the survey. You took part in part of that survey. You found that 26% of former inmates remained unemployed for 5 years after their release, and that a majority of the released persons found only part-time jobs or temporary jobs. Well, they had to eat during that 5 years and have some place to live, and the family bore that burden.
Yes.
You must have witnessed some very heroic families as you did this survey.
Quite frankly, our survey actually showed not only the hardships, but it also showed the resiliency of the family to keep on thriving and trying to survive in these conditions. And I think that also when you look at the things that you have just talked about, it removes this fallacy that we have that men who are incarcerated, especially our African-American men, they had no connections or no responsibilities to their families. And I think what this report does, it actually shows that in spite of the male's plight in being incarcerated prior to incarceration, he was the one that was actually still within the family unit taking care of his family, quite frankly, by any means that were necessary for him to do so. However, he was there, so it takes away this picture of especially African-American men being deadbeat to their responsibilities as men to their families.
Many people don't know what families go through, what defendants facing serious charges go through. I learned from coverage of your survey that there are states that charge defendants extra fees for a jury trial, which we all were taught was the right of every citizen, everyone arrested in this country, to have a trial by jury.
Yes, that's correct. A lot of times in a lot of states, which that survey did show, is that when a person chooses to go to trial and defend him or herself against the charges leveled against he or she, then at the end of that trial, when that process is over, they are levied with court fees that often entail paying back the court for the cost of what it took to try their case. Yes.
You spoke of the resilience of these families. Well, certainly the state does not help them overcome these family crises resulting from incarceration. Just communicating with loved ones via phone if they're in prison can be a tremendous financial hardship.
Yes, we found across the board that that problem is common in states where the states have these outrageous contracts with phone companies that do nothing more than to exploit hardship, not of the individual that is incarcerated, because they know that most individuals that are incarcerated, they don't have jobs. So if you're calling your loved one, you're calling their phone, and your loved one is responsible for paying that bill.
So when these states pile up these fees on inmates and charges and even want to charge the equivalent of rent, all in the name of punishment of the inmate, but they are actually punishing the families of the person they have locked up.
And that was just the point. It's almost like double jeopardy thing. If I'm incarcerated, then not only am I going to pay, but my family is going to pay, and then I'm going to continue to pay, and my family is going to continue to pay even after I am released from prison.
Well, that certainly does give ammunition to those who say that mass black incarceration is not an anti-crime strategy, but it's really meant to punish, to harm the black community as a whole.
Yes, and I think when we talk about mass incarceration in this whole issue, I think, you know, we have to give a lot of credit to Michelle Alexander when she wrote her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, because it put this whole conversation in a way that people can relate it to. It's just a different system. But this has a different face from that of Jim Crow. So as Jim Crow was actually just an extension of the plantation's slave system, then we have to understand that what we know as criminal justice or crime and punishment in America has largely been a replication of what Jim Crow was in a lot of ways.
And what kind of recommendations came out of this survey? What's the Ella Baker Center and its partner in this project? What do they recommend?
We recommend, first of all, that our federal, our state, and local politicians who are responsible for creating policies that are built around criminal justice and incarceration, that they start taking a different approach to the way that they actually look at incarceration. So that one of the things is that we start reinvesting the dollars and cents that we have, that we are going to save now from there being less people in the prison, and then investing those dollars back into the communities that are most impacted by incarceration in the first place. Because one of the things that are deeply connected with the conditions that cause people to live outside of the traditional bounds of society is poverty. I think it was in 1965 where Lyndon Johnson started this war on poverty, and that never came to fruition because we started a war on drugs, which actually came to mass incarcerations. And that war was basically placed upon communities of color, especially African American people. So we have to begin to offset poverty. And so unless you address poverty and all the systemic issues that come along with poverty, then in the next 20 years, all of this talk about mass incarceration, ending it will have gone nowhere. So it's about looking at smart policies. Like, for instance, our prison systems have become the holding place for the mentally ill. Mental health services are more needed within our communities to treat people that have mental health problems instead of using our local jails and prisons to do this. So we have to look at ways of expanding services and outreach to people that are in our communities to get them mental health services. And then one of the things is that our mass incarceration rate for so long, especially here in California, it was always highly driven by recidivism. So it's just, you know, keeping people in the same old state, not giving an individual a real chance to assimilate back into society. We have to start having some real questions on banning the box, but not just banning the box, but making sure that people, that businesses and corporations that come into our communities to operate businesses, then they have to have policies that say, you know, you cannot discriminate against those who have been incarcerated, because a person in record of incarceration does not have any bearing on the type of work that he will do for an individual. So I think those are just some of the things that we have to start doing and making policies that are more geared toward allowing individuals to become part of mainstream society. Yes.
But even before tackling the problem of poverty in general, the state at least can stop inflicting more poverty on people through the incarceration system, the burden for which falls on these poor families.
Right. And ways to do that are stop imposing all these high fines and fees. And another thing is to not allow telephone companies like AT&T and Sprint and the other ones to exploit the love that a family still has for someone in spite of the fact that they're incarcerated. And in that way, that's taken a lot of the burden away. And then also just looking at ways to say, you know, I can't keep criminalizing an individual despite what he or she has done. You know, if I have committed a crime and I've paid my debt to society, then how come when I come out, I can't live here or I can't live there? Because that's added burden, that's added debt. When a family can't live together, then the economics are split in a way where it's going two different ways instead of just for one way. The future of our country, in my estimation, hangs in the balance of this conversation that we're beginning to have today, because we can never go back to the thinking that we've had in the 90s and the late 80s when we started to incarcerate many people. And then we have to also, I believe, our government has to answer. They still have not answered and been held accountable to some of the conditions that they have created that caused our prison populations to grow. And that was when they systematically picked out communities of color to dump drugs into and guns and everything while exploiting all the jobs that kept communities vibrant and afloat overseas so they could exploit that labor also and at the same time keep our people down.
That was Darris Young of the Eller Baker Center for Human Rights in Oakland, California.
Activists are kicking off the autumn season with a Rise Up October campaign against police killings in the black community, culminating in protests in New York City October 22nd through 24th. Carl Dix is a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network.
We are coming off of a year of rising resistance to the epidemic of police getting away with murder that was really jumped off with the murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York, but especially with the response of people standing up saying this must stop at a level that we hadn't seen in decades. But we've reached a crucial turning point because the authorities have not only doubled on unleashing their police to brutalize and murder people and backing them up and exonerating them when they do, but they have also taken to trying to demonize the protest movement, talking about it being responsible for a non-existent war in cops, one that doesn't really exist, but through that, trying to demonize the resistance, suppress it, and push people out of the streets. And when our movement gets pushed out of the streets, as Gil Scott-Heron said, it gets taken to the cleaners. So we feel we have to meet that with redoubled resistance, resistance taken to a higher level. And that's what Rise Up October is aiming for and what we called for it to do. Three powerful days of resistance, beginning with October 22nd, the National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, which will again be marked in cities across the country with demonstrations and other forms of resistance, but then continuing, it's Friday, October 23rd in New York City, where there will be a major nonviolent direct action focusing on an institution of the criminal injustice system in this country, and then culminating in October 24th, a huge march in New York City, where thousands upon thousands of people from around the country descend on New York City and join up with thousands upon thousands of people from the New York area, and through the sheer weight of our numbers, shut it down. The theme for this activity is Stop Police Terror. Which side are you on? Because we feel like we need to challenge all of society to take a stand on this, because there is no middle ground, no neutrality when police are getting away with murder. You are either for stopping that horror or you're on the other side.
It's very difficult to gauge whether police murders of civilians is up, since the police have always refused to give reliable data. But they do keep track of their own, that is, how many police officers have been killed. And in terms of demonization, what we see is that felonious deaths of police, that is, when they die, when someone has committed a crime against a police officer, are at a 35-year low, and that we're on track this year to have only 35 officers killed. The average for the last 35 years has been 65 in a year. So if there's a war against police, it's taking very few casualties.
Yes, exactly. And that's why I called it the non-existent war on police, because there has been a media push on this theme that the Black Lives Matter movement has made things more dangerous for police. But the actual reality is that fewer police have been killed this year than the previous year, and a low for a number of years. And it's very important that people not fall for that, because, look, police brutality, police murder and that's police killing people, not police being killed, is the concentration of an overall genocidal program targeting black people and also hitting broad sections of Latinos, the indigenous peoples of this country. And it is something that must be stopped. And Rise Up October is aimed at making a big leap forward in the level of resistance to stopping it. And that's what we're aiming at doing. And as part of doing that, we have to push aside this confusion that is being deliberately spread by the authorities over who's to blame, whose fault is it. We have to take on this talk of there being a war on cops. We also have to take on the attempt to divert things by throwing in the question of, well, black on black crime is really the problem, and that's really what we need to deal with. Who geared the educational system to fail our youth? Again, it wasn't our youth or our people, it was the system. So the system enforces the conditions that have our youth at each other, fighting each other, and then they unleash their police to suppress us, including our youth, because they fear what our response will be to those conditions that they're enforcing. So they're hitting us from both sides and then trying to divert us from dealing with them and saying, deal with your own problems, when our problems are being enforced by them. So I say to people, especially to the young people who are caught up in this, you've got to get out of this and take on the real enemy. Don't put your anger at others. Oppressed people who are in the same situation as you, put it to the system, the capitalist system that's responsible for the problems, and stand up as part of doing something about these problems, which on one level requires a movement for revolution, which I'm working on building, and at the same time, right now, it requires people getting with Rise Up October, being in the streets in New York City, saying no more to the police getting away with murdering our people. One last point I want to add. We have a project to bring 100 families of people murdered by the police to New York City. We're going to read the names of the victims. We're going to have celebrities and other well-known people joining with these families for the reading of the names. We're going to have the huge march on Saturday, October 24th in New York City. Anybody who wants to get involved should go to the website stopmassincarceration.net. or riseupoctober.org. They can find out information there and ways to get involved.
Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network.
The flood of refugees into Europe continues, with most fleeing the war against Syria by Islamic jihadists, backed by the U.S. and its allies. The Russians have speeded up military aid to the Syrian government. President Obama claims that Russian help will only make the situation worse, but Sarah Founders of the United National Anti-War Coalition says that's insane.
This really exposes the total hypocrisy of the U.S. position on Syria. And from the very beginning, the war in Syria has been about tearing down the government of Syria and creating a completely chaotic, destabilized state, which leaves Israel and the U.S. as the strong forces in the region. It's an effort aimed directly at the Palestinian movement and at any form of independence in Lebanon. It's aimed directly also at Hezbollah in Lebanon. And the effort by completely destabilizing Syria is also a demand that Russia and Iran abandon the legal sovereign government of Syria and allow U.S. domination in the region. Now, Russia has had a decades-long relationship with the Syrian government and has provided invaluable both military and infrastructure and industrial aid over many years that allowed Syria to develop a very high standard of living, highest educational standing in the entire region, and able to save and preserve its culture, which is thousands of years old. All of this Russian assistance and earlier Of course, it was based on earlier Soviet assistance during the Cold War. It enabled Syria to stand up to Israeli aggression, even though Syria, its land in the Golan Heights, is occupied since 1967 by Israel. So this long-term relationship the U.S. was determined to end through a war very much based on the war in Libya, and that is through sending in mercenaries to dominate and control the entire region. We need to then look at the very justification for the so-called U.S. war on ISIS, because their moderate, as they called them, opposition was completely caved in, unable to operate at all, and totally defeated by the Syrian government. And suddenly a new force arose in the region called the Islamic State, which was funded by Saudi Arabia and Turkey, both U.S. proxies in this war. The U.S. claimed that they were at war against ISIL, and yet seem unable to strike them with all their satellite reconnaissance to do any real damage to their bases, to their convoys, and at the same time, it has been justification for further destruction of Syrian infrastructure.
And let us not forget al-Nusra, which is the official al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, certainly the second strongest military force, which some in the United States establishment, General Petraeus, for example, seem to consider to be part of the so-called moderate opposition.
That's such a good point, because it shows that those that they're labeling moderates are themselves absolutely fanatical and reactionary forces. And what's especially important, they're not Syrian forces. This is an invasion by mercenary forces and religious jihadist fanatical forces from some 80 countries. There is a pouring in of forces very well paid, equipped, and trained, with bases in Turkey. And Turkey very much wants to create a kind of a free fire zone in Syria. They also see it as a force in their continuing struggle against the Kurdish people in Turkey. So all of this is a very destructive plan. And in it, the U.S. has absolutely created, armed and funded, the most reactionary forces. And when those forces weren't enough, there was a creation of an even more fanatical force, and that is the Islamic State. All of these contending forces have no ability to in any way govern or administer a state, as we see from the example in Libya, where almost half the population of Libya today are exiles, are refugees living in Tunisia, living in other countries, desperately trying to get into Europe, because there's nothing left in Libya. There's a complete destruction of the infrastructure, and that is their plan for Syria. It's total destabilization. They can destroy, but they can't administer a breadline. They can't administer health care. They can't run schools. They can't run the water, the sanitation, the sewage, the electrical grid. They can't do anything that the average person needs. And today, the displaced population of Syria is into 10 million, almost half the population displaced. 7 million of those people are internally displaced within Syria, where the government is forced and is providing still schools, people packed into former schools, two families to a classroom. I saw this myself when I was in Damascus, where you see the government still providing food, basic education, basic health care for a large displaced population forced out of cities that are just bombed by these reactionary forces, where people are in great fear. Now, when Russia has said that it will continue its military assistance to the government of Syria, the U.S. is demanding that they stop, that this is an escalation, that Russia should abandon Syria and abandon the government, that the only way to peace, they demand again and again, every State Department statement, every statement from Kerry or Obama, is that President Assad, who is the elected president of Syria, must step down. and that their jihadist forces must have a role in the government. And this is completely a criminal act from start to finish.
So the great crisis of refugees from Syria, the onus falls on those parties that have invaded Syria and destroyed its societies, which includes much of Europe.
That is exactly true, that in this war on Syria, the European Union, the EU countries, particularly France, who's a former colonial power in the region, and Germany, have absolutely, Britain also, been collaborating in this war and are very anxious to actually expand the war. And certainly Britain was moved to do that, maybe a little bit more difficult with the recent Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn. But nevertheless, they also wanted to get into the bombing of Syria. So a lot of it is a pre-positioning for an expanded war on Syria, which the U.S. tried to do, and we shouldn't forget this. And when they continue to say that their plan is for regime change or that President Assad must step down, that these totally reactionary forces must have a role in the government, every one of these statements, the U.S. plan originally, and they demanded it of the U.N., they couldn't get it accepted there. They demanded it of NATO. This is 2 years ago. They couldn't get it there. They demanded it of the U.S. Congress, and there was quite a struggle, and they couldn't get it there. And so they have gone at it from a different direction, and that is convincing people that the threat now is ISIL and that their bombing is against the Islamic State. And that, in fact, has not been true. And they are fearful that Russian aid could actually allow the Syrian government to continue its war against ISIL and against all of these reactionary forces, because that is the only way that reaction will be defeated in Syria, is by the Syrian people and the Syrian government itself. And it is quite an amazing thing that going into the fifth year now, the government has been able to provide a unified resistance, because Syria does stand for a government of all the people and all the different religious groups. It was always a multi-ethnic, multi-religious state. There is a deep commitment on the part of both Muslim, Sunni, and Shia, and Alawite, and Christian forces in Syria not to allow a fanatical, really reactionary takeover by groups who are not even Syrian and are armed by the reactionary monarchies of the region and by the U.S., with real assistance also. It's been exposed again and again, the assistance that Israel is giving in the Golan Heights to these same forces, that the monarchy of Jordan is giving, and that Turkey, a 60-year member of NATO, is also giving in camps that are organizational centers for the reactionary forces. There's a big mobilization in the region to bring Syria down, and Syria so far has resisted with assistance from Hezbollah and also with assistance from Iran and assistance from Russia.
From an historic perspective, isn't it bizarre that countries, especially in Western Europe, which for 500 years invaded and colonized and preyed upon and occupied most of the world, are now in a hysteria because folks from the Middle East and from Africa are seeking refuge there today?
It's the height of hypocrisy. The very countries that have done so much to destabilize formerly colonized countries, developing countries where there was a high rate of health, education, infrastructure, they've totally destroyed it and laid waste to it. And then when desperate people come to their shores, they want to cast them adrift again or act as great humanitarian saviors. So they show images around the world of desperate Syrian and Afghan and Iraqi refugees chanting, "Germany, Germany," when they're just trying to find a safe haven, find some way of finding a place to lay their heads, finding some protection for their families. So this is hypocrisy. It's a world-scale publicity campaign of the very racist imperialist forces that have looted the world and played a role even in the last 5 years in laying further waste. There was a U.S. occupation and invasion of Iraq, but then all the NATO countries took part in that occupation of Iraq. There was a U.S. complete destruction and bombing of Libya, and then all the NATO and EU countries took part also in that looting of Libya. And we now see the same thing going on in Syria. And the result is millions of desperate refugees forced out of their own countries. And an example also, it spirals out. There are tens of thousands of workers throughout Africa who used to have good paying jobs in the oil industries and building infrastructure in Libya, which was a country with a very small population. They had, compared to anywhere else in the region, very good working relations within Libya. With the destruction, African workers became targeted by these reactionary militias in the most outrageous ways. They were burned out of settlements and encampments and pushed back into the rest of Africa. So this is another source of the refugee waves now hitting Europe. We could look at also, I think this is very much part of what's happened in Syria and in Libya, the U.S. support for the creation of the artificial state of South Sudan, from the beginning seen totally as a U.S. protectorate, and it's resulted now in 2 million refugees in South Sudan, desperate people because a state was set up that had no ability to govern and instead are fighting each other over oil revenues. It's a free-for-all, and it's not in any way, this is completely a U.S.-created problem, and 2 million South Sudanese refugees, 2 million Libyan refugees living now in Tunisia, millions more displaced. We see 10 million Syrian refugees of U.S.-created war in Syria. So this is a huge problem, and as only a handful, a couple hundred thousand try to reach Europe. It has Europe in a tailspin, refusing to accept the refugees that their own imperialist governments have helped to create. And of course, the U.S. role in this is to say that they might accept over the next several years 100,000 Syrian refugees, maybe, with big question marks as to who it will be or how that will exist. But it's less than 1% of the total refugees that U.S. policy has created.
By my count, if the Sunni jihadist Islamists prevail in Syria, about one-third of the country would face annihilation, could not possibly live there. That includes the Alawites, the Christians, the Druze, the Kurds, and others. How possibly could the United States and its European allies support a situation in which one-third of a nation would have to flee? And would Europe like to accommodate all of them?
Well, that's such a good example of where there's no rational planning on any of this. No thought to what the future means when there are U.S. wars. This is absolutely not part of the plan. And we saw that in Iraq, where the U.S. could bomb, invade, occupy, and yet had no plan on how on earth they would run the country. And it led to a howling disaster for one of the oldest civilizations on earth. And millions of people displaced, and so much just completely destroyed. You had a highly educated population, and now who's in school? The schools aren't running. The healthcare system isn't running. And in Syria, a much worse situation. And do the Washington policymakers care? No, they don't at all. As a matter of fact, it is part of their plan. Destabilization and what they say, a recreation, redrawing the national boundaries of the entire region. And that is their plan for both the Middle East and for Africa. To completely destabilize the region and leave as the prevailing powers in the region, the reactionary Saudi regime, United Arab Emirates, governments that have no democracy whatsoever, and the Zionist state of Israel. That's what they want to have, and chaos in the rest of the region. And when they talk about it very consciously about how to redivide Iraq, how to redivide Syria, it means very ancient peoples are driven out that have lived in harmony, not only in this period, but for hundreds of years. The Christian and Alawite forces are ancient peoples within Syria today and have lived with Sunni and Shia neighbors in a protected status, and suddenly now find themselves complete refugees, their very religious identity being a source of a death warrant on them against Islamic State fanatics. So they don't have a plan on this. As a matter of fact, their plan is destabilization, and it's a situation where the whole world has to stand up to this and call it out and denounce it, because there's been a great silence among important forces in the progressive movement here in the U.S. and worldwide, not seeing it, not understanding it, in a certain sense ignoring these wars because they're not popular and they're fought through a whole number of proxy governments.
That was Sarah Flounders of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition.
James Paul, author of the book Syria Unmasked, agrees that most of the people fleeing Europe from the Middle East and Africa are regime change refugees whose countries have been destabilized by Western military intervention. Paul is the former executive director of the Global Policy Forum and the Middle East Research and Information Project.
The policy goal has been to change those governments. Of course, the official explanation of this has to do with how the government is not meeting its human rights obligations and these kinds of things, that it's an oppressive regime and so on. And that is almost always true. But whether the purpose of the regime change is in fact to do that, or by contrast to have greater control over the oil resources or to engage in rivalry with other great powers. These are the real influences over policy and not promoting democracy, as we can see from the results. Because if you look at Egypt, for example, the Egyptian people managed to get rid of a dictator, Mubarak, who'd been in rule for a very long time with considerable support from the United States, it should be said. And then the government that came into power was there for only quite a short time, about a year and a half, and then it was overthrown again by a military means, and that's the present government of General Sisi, which is a very dictatorial government, has the support of the United States. So the United States does not go around withholding support from dictators and supporting democratic governments. The pattern is not that at all, and I think it's very important to recognize that.
And of course, a policy that results in empowerment of jihadists, as in Syria and in Libya, could not possibly be a policy in promotion of democracy.
That's right. It couldn't. And we see this, actually, if we go back to Afghanistan, the pattern of supporting Islamic fundamentalist groups and movements is very consistent. It's almost the standard playbook, you might say. And as we know, in Afghanistan, there was a rivalry with Russia. Of course, in Syria, there's a rivalry with Russia, too, and in Iraq and a number of other places. But in Afghanistan in particular, this was the great, they called it the Great Game back in the 19th century, but anyway, it was the United States was upset that the Russians had too much influence in Afghanistan. And so in order to counter that, it actually was a secular government. It's true, it was very pro-Russian or pro-Soviet at the time, but it was a secular government. And women had considerable rights and so on. And then I wouldn't say it was a very democratic government, but it was certainly, and the country was more or less at peace, and then the CIA began to arm, along with the Saudis, began to arm and create, really, this movement called the Mujahideen, and that turned into a very long, bloody civil war, and President Carter's National Security Advisor at the time, Zbigniew Brzezinski. He bragged about how he lured the Russians into the quagmire of a war like the one that the United States had had in Vietnam. So that's the cruel and terrible attitude that you have in Washington, which ignores the terrible price that the people in the particular country or place have to pay for these geostrategic goals like making the Russians pay and so on.
You've been studying this part of the world for a long time. Of course, there have always been jihadists, but until that U.S.-Saudi connection in Afghanistan, there never existed an international jihadist network. That is the United States and Saudi Arabia's gift to the world.
Yes, I would say. I mean, I think there are probably some other players that have contributed to this whole program, and as you say, there's always an ultra-Orthodox version of Islam floating around out there. But the United States also more or less solidified and kept in being this very strange state that is called Saudi Arabia that probably would never have continued to exist. The United States made special treaty arrangements with Saudi Arabia back in the late 1930s, and there's a picture of President Roosevelt on board a U.S. naval cruiser somewhere in the Red Sea, him and the founder of the Saudi state, Ibn Saud, sitting together on the deck of this cruiser and making the arrangements for U.S. support for this then fledgling government. And of course, Ibn Saud gave the United States oil companies the rights to prospect for oil. It turned out that Saudi Arabia was the biggest place of oil reserves in the whole world, so that turned out to be a very good deal for the oil companies. And the Saudi regime, which is this very, very backward, probably the most backward country in the whole world, but it has an awful lot of money, and so the United States periodically sells lots of arms to this country and does all sorts of deals with them, and the oil keeps flowing and the arms keep piling up over there. So Saudi Arabia, there's a state religion, which is this is called the Wahhabi version of Islam, which is very, very orthodox and very backward, and they try to export that in all sorts of ways all over the world. So this is one of the ways that the United States contributes to the promotion of democracy in the world. And alas, also the human rights organizations who should be mentioning this, you know, they keep their mouth shut when it comes to these things.
And so we have the consequence, finally, of these waves of refugees flowing into Europe. But the prescription coming from the United States and its NATO allies in Europe is more war in Syria.
That's right. Unfortunately, official policy is very oriented towards the use of violence, towards war making, and they don't seem to really know much about anything else. I mean, once in a great while, there's something like the nuclear agreement with Iran that seems to hint that peaceful route to international relations is a good one, but war, for the most part, is their answer. So yes, constant bombing of Syria and Iraq, and that bombing is supposedly aimed at the military formations of the Islamic State, but in fact, they hit lots of civilian targets. And anyway, these civil wars have to be ended through a complex process of negotiation and agreement by all the different parties involved. The United States has to tell the Saudis to stop arming the various different Islamic forces. The United States itself has to stop arming Islamic forces. The Brits and the French have to stop doing that. The Turks are complicit in a particular way. In Jordan, there's the Jordanian government is allowing the movement of arms and fighters up through in the southern sector of Syria, for instance. So it's a conflict involving a lot of players and a lot of different arms flows and all those things. And so that has to be stopped by some kind of international negotiation and agreement. And the United Nations has proposed one. It's called the Geneva Process. It was started out in 2012. And it was a roadmap that was laid out by Kofi Annan, who has been the former Secretary General of the United Nations, who was the special envoy of the Secretary General for Syria. And he made some proposals. And the United States government said, no, we can't have the Iranians come to this thing. That wouldn't be the right thing to do. We refuse. We won't come if the Iranians are there. And Kofi Annan said, well, yes, but they're part of this whole picture. They have to be, because they were and are supporting the government of Bashar al-Assad. And so then and the United States said, and furthermore, there can't be anybody who's a representative of Assad and his regime. And Kofi Annan said, yes, but you may not like them, but that's what negotiations are all about. We have to bring all the parties together. And then a third thing was, there's a very broad-based Syrian democratic and nonviolent opposition, secular, which is probably the political formation that has the most support on the ground in Syria. And the United States didn't want them there either. So they just wanted to have people that they were supporting to be present, so that in the end of the day, whatever settlement was, they would control the outcome. They would control the government that was going to issue from this particular discussion. And that's the way they are. They play very hardball. They think about hegemony, geostrategic domination, and all that sort of thing, and not the well-being. They were prepared to have another 3.5 years of civil war after that Geneva process, and with all the terrible results, it's gotten worse and worse, and Islamic State and all these things, probably they wouldn't be there if they hadn't refused these conditions that were being set by the United Nations, not by any one party. So we can only hope that something now might come of it, but it's hard to imagine that it will, given what the prior behavior has been in Washington.
And finally, some folks have great difficulty summoning up empathy for Europe and its difficulties with refugees, because this is a part of the world that has invaded and colonized the rest of the world and planted its populations all over the world and displaced other populations and even exterminated native populations, but now claims the right to keep Europe white.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there are different degrees of response that different countries have had to this. And for a while there, it looked like the Germans had the best. And then, of course, the Swedes were also quite welcoming of the refugees. But there were neo-Nazi groups inside of Germany, for example, that were firebombing buildings that had been built to receive refugees. And so that was also a sign of this extreme attitudes and racism and Nazi hysteria that there is in a certain part of the German population and in other countries too. So, yes, it's right. But I think the biggest gift that the Europeans could give to the refugees in their countries is to look into ending these military interventions and to actually contribute to peacemaking there. There's so many countries. We were talking about Syria, but as I said in the beginning, there must be a dozen countries in the periphery of Europe, including in the Balkans, in Ukraine, and then going all the way out to Afghanistan and down to Africa, at least as far as the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, Eritrea, and all this. And instead of bombing and sending troops in there, actually look for a peaceful settlement. That's the way that Europeans could overcome their racist attitude towards their neighbors.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.